Last Sunday, the Reverend Shana shared with us one aspect of the Christian story. Today is the sequel, another version of the truth. Multiple interpretations of the Bible, both Old and New Testament, have been around so long, and as long as there have been people to hear and to read the words. A myriad of religious sects have been spawned, ranging from the literalists and the traditionalist to the picker and chooser, and on to the individual free thinker. Unitarians have often been called the free thinkers. Controversy and repression, spin-offs, and freedom of choice have resulted. Back in 1992, a new publication again challenged the foundations of established beliefs. It was entitled Jesus and the Riddle of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and later it was called Jesus the Man. The author was Australian-born Barbara Thiering. She maintained that there was not a virgin birth in the literal sense. There were no miracles in the literal sense. There was no resurrection in the literal sense. But, according to Thiering, everything in the New Testament was the gospel truth, if read aright. The times and places were written down at the time of Jesus and accurately recorded the events. The records were basically for the inner circle who understood the code and therefore could follow the hidden double meaning. This technique is called Pesher. You'll hear more about that later. Remember, those were troubled times with rule from Rome and political factions vying for ascendancy in the Holy Land. A writer just had to be secretive. The people were seeking order and meaning in the midst of chaos. Dr. Barbara Thiering has impressive theological credentials. She took 4 degrees in theology. She has published numerous articles and 7 books. Her work was featured in a documentary film called The Riddle of the Dead Sea Scrolls. She taught for 22 years at Sydney University's School of Divinity and is now a full-time writer and researcher. None of us here today are experts in biblical scholarship, but we are all fascinated by her research and interpretation. So today we will present the highlights of her research.
You've heard Christine's introduction, and my part is the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, Thiering's opening thoughts about Jesus the man. There can be few people in the world who don't have some curiosity about Jesus. Where the rise of the church and the growth of Christianity due solely to his extraordinary personality? Or were the events of his life and his teachings real events in history? Or were they something quite outside our normal experience? Thiering continued, "My family valued education along with attending church, but it was my mother's warning about grandmother's devotion to the Bible that led me to read it and became deeply involved in church social long after I became restless about its doctrines. My degrees in theology eventually led to my study of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now it's history. In 1947, Bedouin boys found a number of jars containing scrolls in a cave overlooking the ruins of Qumran on the shores of the famous Dead Sea. During Jesus' time, Qumran was an important religious center relating to writings of the gospel. Now, these boys were quite clever, and they took the scrolls to an antiques dealer in Bethlehem for money. Eventually, academics became entranced with the scrolls, which showed verification of long-known biblical writings. But there was nothing new until further searchers. The temple scrolls were discovered and eventually held in abeyance for years by dealers and archaeologists. Then, if you remember, way back in 1947, the Six Days War resulted in a member of the Israeli Intelligence Corps locating the shop of this dealer, and they confiscated the scroll, but at least they paid for it. A miracle had happened. This priceless document had survived. It's a personal note. When I was a young man in Edmonton, involved with the United Church, I was part of a panel reviewing the meaning of the scrolls at that time. What this led to me was I became a Unitarian. Riddles are part of the scrolls, and the use of the Pescher technique is vital in discovering historical events and that were purposely concealed. Now, this process revolves that symbols, images, places, and persons are not necessarily what they seem, but to analyze the reasoning. All words must be accounted for to discover the hidden meanings. Gospel readings of time, places, names which appear impossible to the natural eye now become quite accurate. Such as travel time was deduced from easy walking distance in a hot climate. Living quarters of delegates to Qumran were given place names from where people came. And for example, the living quarters of someone from Nazareth was called Nazareth. Do you realize we do this today? For example, in backroom legalese, the silk talks to the bench. And we all know about nursery rhymes. They all have double meanings, like the Pescher technique of the Gospels. If you recall, sing a song of sixpence. Well, the king, Henry VIII, was in the counting house, counting out his money. The queen was in the parlor, eating bread and honey. And we all know what happened to Anne Boleyn.
Good morning. My time allows me just a little of what Dr. To tell you just a little of what Dr. Thiering says about the start of the Christian church and how Jesus got involved with the Gentiles. Over the years, large numbers of Jews had emigrated from their homeland and were known collectively as the diaspora. To these people, the attractions of Hellenism or Greek culture was so great that many were beginning to lose their sense of Jewish distinctiveness. Their Gentile neighbors, on the other hand, especially in the West, were not so sure about joining an alien culture that required circumcision, strict food laws, and temple attendance, but they were strongly attracted to the Jewish theology and ethics. The two needs grew together and towards each other and enabled the Christian church to begin. Herod the Great was the key founder of the initial organization. He was not even a Jew, but he had converted to a version of Judaism that suited him, and he proceeded to impose it on the world, his world. During the first century BC, A mission from the Palestinian Jews to the diaspora Jews was organized under Herod's leadership. Herod wanted to control the flow of money. He wanted it to be a flood of money to be used for his building projects. Missionaries went out to all the great cities of the diaspora and found Jews who were in danger of lapsing from their faith. The Judaism that they were taught was greatly modified, updated, and Hellenized. When diaspora Jews joined this new covenant, they were baptized in water and went through an initiation rite that gave membership, salvation, and forgiveness of sin upon the payment of a half shekel, which is about a day's income. And that's how missionaries, baptism, and indulgences started. Herod's work. The missionaries gave initiates a white stone from the Jordan River on which was written their new name and a badge with the emblem of the religious order they were joining. As Christine said, the literacy rate was pretty low in those days, so they used symbols for a lot of things. A sheep meant they were village Essenes. A dove meant they stood for peace. Workers used an ox, and so forth. When the missionaries handed out these badges in exchange for a half shekel, it could be said that they were selling oxen, sheep, and doves, and turning religion into a shop. Jesus took the strongest objection to selling religious salvation for money and taught instead that religion was not a financial racket, but a gift from God. And that's the history behind the story of Jesus and the money changers. All of this built up a framework within which the Christian church developed. At the same time, the Jews in the diaspora began to feel a sense of unity and purpose under Herod. The idea grew that they were part of a glorious religious movement which would usher in a 1,000-year kingdom of the Jews, which would be the greatest empire yet known. This world was divided in two parts with three leaders under Herod. Jerusalem was the center, and the leader there was called Abraham, the father, and later called the Pope. The eastern part, considered the most important, had the patriarch called Isaac. The western section included Rome and was considered to be less important. The patriarch there was called Jacob. Jesus' grandfather, whose name was Heli, was the direct descendant of King David and was pretender to the Jewish throne. He was the first Jacob to work in the West, and part of his job was the baptism and initiation of Gentiles. He was humbling himself to work with these uncircumcised, ritually unclean people. His son Joseph took over the work in his turn, and he was followed by his son Jesus. And that's how Jesus got involved with the Gentiles. But his involvement seemed to go far beyond that of his predecessors. Why? Jesus was always on the side of those who suffered from the system. The poor, the disabled, the socially excluded, as well as the Gentiles.
So my part is an explanation, Dr. Tiering's explanation of the virgin birth. And as you might expect, it arises out of the same traditions from the Qumran Essene community where Jesus was born. And the short story is that unmarried women in this community were known as virgins. And that probably sums up most of your questions. But, of course, there's a slightly longer story. So in the community, certain important lines of heritage were preserved by ritualistic marriages. And one of these lines was the line of the King of David. The current king of, head of that household was Jacob Healy, and his son was Joseph. And so when Joseph turned 36, it was his turn to marry in order to preserve the line. So marriage in the community was a long and arduous process. There was a long lead up of engagement with increasingly symbolic and binding ties, and Joseph was engaged to Mary. So at the end of the engagement, there was a trial marriage that started in the holy month of September. And then, after 3 months, in December, the marriage would first be consummated with the hope that a child would be born in the following holy September. Then once the woman was 3 months pregnant, then there would be a final marriage, which was binding. And then they would be said to be married, the woman would lose her title of virgin, and the man would return to celibacy and his old status in the community. Now, Jesus was born in March, so something didn't go right with that timeline. I know Christmas, but I think it's pretty common knowledge that we've moved the date of Jesus' birth to accommodate the midwinter festivals. But Jesus was born in March, so the timeline was off, which means that Joseph had an important decision to make, whether he would acknowledge Jesus as his son or whether he would turn him away. So Joseph went and spoke to the angel Gabriel, who was probably one of the prominent priests, and he decided that he would acknowledge Jesus. So, nevertheless, there was a split, and the Orthodox refused to acknowledge Jesus as the heir to the line, and as a result, he was born in the symbolic Bethlehem, where all unacknowledged children were born. And that place, the symbolic Bethlehem, where somebody from Bethlehem had stayed, as you heard earlier, was also where they kept a lot of the pack animals. I've got a climby little girl here. All right. And also where they kept a lot of the pack animals, so it was also known colloquially as the stables. And that is how Jesus ended up being born in the stables. Now, there were those who did approve and recognize the acknowledgement, and those were the new liberal diaspora Essenes. And so they came to witness the birth, and they were the shepherds and kings of the Christmas story. And that is how we explain the virgin birth. Thank you.
I wish to share with you an interpretation of one of the miracles using Thiering's Pesher technique. In the year 32 AD, Jesus intensified his program of promotion of Gentiles to the point of having them replace the Jewish clergy. From the Jewish point of view, this was one of his greatest outrages. The original form of Herod's mission was a liberal form of Judaism. It attracted many Gentiles who were tolerated only if they became full Jews, including, of course, circumcision. If they did not, they were only allowed as far as baptism with water. The miracle of changing water into wine meant that Jesus was breaking with tradition by allowing those inferior, uncircumcised Gentiles to receive communion, that is, wine, and not just baptism by water. From that time on, all adult members of Jesus' following, whether married, Gentiles, women, physically handicapped, slaves, or free, were made welcome. This was a most important statement. All were equal in the eyes of God. The crucifixion and feeding of the 5,000 are the only stories found in all four Gospels. The latter is important because it is an account of the first ordination of what was to become Christian ministers. The priesthood for Jews was a privilege of birth, as they had to be born into the tribe of Levi. This was a big step to let Gentiles join in baptism and communion, let alone be ministers of the faith. In the traditional Jewish worship, priests and Levites officiated in the sanctuary where there was a table holding 12 loaves of bread. 12 Levites served the bread to the holy people present. The traditional association between Levites and bread was such that Levites could be called loaves. The 7 higher Levites served first, and then the 5 lower Levites ministered to the lay people. But in the year 32, Jesus miraculously transformed Gentile laymen of the lowest kind into loaves, who could minister to ordinary Gentiles at Gentile services and serve bread and wine. Quite a revolution. Gentiles were now like priests. One can see how the multitudes could be fed by the Gentiles who were thus ordained. This miracle records the beginning of the apostolic succession that goes on to the very present day in the Christian church. A social revolution was implied. So you can see from this, Jesus, according to Thiering, was a real human being, a fallible figure, but pivotal in human history. Strip away the mystery and the so-called miracles, and know him as he really was. His followers wanted us to understand the full story by writing the Gospels as they did in the Pesher technique.
Intrigue, violence, hanky-panky, retribution, betrayal. All the elements of a soap opera, or, if you like, a masterpiece theater drama. Well, my talk has these elements in it for sure. It includes the two significant women in Jesus' life, but mostly it will be about the crucifixion. All of it is based on research done by Barbara Thiering. The first significant woman in Jesus' life was, of course, his mother, and Cody has spoken of her within the context of the virgin birth. The other woman of importance was Mary Magdalene. You will know why as the story unfolds. Jesus, with his disciples, began his ministry in the community. 3 women often walked with him. They were his mother, her sister, and Mary Magdalene, a young woman who was called his companion. The disciples took note of this and one day asked Jesus, "Why do you love her more than us?" To which Jesus replied with one of his enigmatic statements. It was Mary Magdalene who anointed Jesus' feet with nard, a fragrant ointment. A little hint there. Now, Jesus, through his father, was a direct descendant of King David. It was imperative that he marry and father a son to ensure the continuation of the lineage. The woman he chose to be his wife was, Mary Magdalene. Their betrothal was followed, after the established time had elapsed, by the first marriage. Jesus was 36, Mary 27. By the time of the second marriage, Mary had already given birth to a daughter, Tamar. This sin was to cause a lot of trouble later on. Mary's second child was the longed-for son, given the name Jesus Justice. The birth of a second son, James, completed the family. Throughout this time, Jesus continued his ministry of compassion. He advocated for the underprivileged and expressed his opposition to Jewish law and ritual. Inexplicably, he still remained aligned with the Eastern, very traditional group of Jews, centered in Rome. And Pat spoke a little about those groups earlier. As more and more people heard and liked the teaching of Jesus, his following grew. But the Roman hierarchy liked him less and less. Meanwhile, in Judea, the new Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, was proving to be an insensitive ruler, caring nothing for the Jews. He stole money from their sacred treasury to use for secular, his own purposes. This so enraged the Galileans that they staged a protest led by Simon, Judas, and Barabbas. These three men, fervent nationalists, labeled as zealots. They led that. The protest became a riot. Pilate's men were ordered to go into the crowd and use their clubs. The riot was soon over. The three zealots ran away, but were soon captured. They were put on trial and convicted, not only for inciting the riot, but for causing general unrest. They were sentenced to be crucified. Barabbas luckily escaped death when Pilate accepted a large bribe to free him. Now Jesus, out of personal loyalty, tried to save Simon. His attempt was unsuccessful, but it added to the many and long list of complaints against him. The priests who were present there at the trial now saw their chance to get rid of Jesus. He was a troublemaker, hated. They insisted that he be brought to trial. The hostile spectators even called for Jesus' death. Now, Pilate was not convinced of any wrongdoing by Jesus, but the priests remained determined. So Pilate washed his hands of the whole thing and left the decision to the Pope. The Pope, who wanted to get rid of Jesus as well, sided with the priests. Jesus was tried, found guilty, his sentence crucifixion. Simon, Judas, and Jesus were taken up to the plateau of Qumran, and there they were crucified. Looking on some distance away from the spectators were Jesus' mother and Mary Magdalene. After enduring 6 hours of agony on the cross, Jesus drank the cup of wine mixed with poison that he had previously refused. Shortly after, he was unconscious. In the words of the scripture, he gave up the spirit. Pilate was amazed and perhaps a bit puzzled that Jesus had died in such a short time. His duty done, Pilate handed the crucified men to the Jews and Jewish law and went back to Rome as fast as his chariot could carry him. Simon and Judas, not yet dead, were taken from their crosses and buried alive in one of the hillside caves used as tombs. This is not quite the end of their story. Simon was soon to be given his freedom, but Judas, who had betrayed all his comrades, in a few days was thrown over the precipice to his death. John Mark, the beloved disciple, was keeping vigil at Jesus' cross. When Jesus' flesh was pierced to verify death, fresh blood appeared, indicating he was still alive. John sent word to James and Barabbas, who came and carried the unconscious man to the cave next to the one that Simon and Judas were in. A lamp was lit to enable those in the dark cave to see what they were doing. Barabbas fetched aloe juice to expel the poison from Jesus' system. Simon was moved into his cave to care for him. Mary Magdalene was staying in a house down on the plain. She was looking up at the caves, the dark caves, when she saw a light flickering. What did that mean? She called Peter and John, and the three walked up the hill to the tomb of Jesus. The men went in. Mary waited a moment. When she entered, In the dim light, she saw a man standing before her whom she did not recognize. "Mary," he said. It was the voice of Jesus. As she took a step toward him, he said, "Do not touch me." These words warned her that he had not been cleansed from his illness. Mary went back to her lodging. Later that evening, Jesus was taken to a house of refuge for his convalescence. After midnight, Mary, with Jesus' mother, returned to the tomb expecting to find him. Instead, there was only Simon. And here I will quote directly from Barbara Thiering. "Simon gave them a message that could be taken in two ways. The message, 'He is risen,' could mean simply that Jesus had earned a higher status by his suffering, or it could be taken to mean that he had been raised from the dead. It was undoubtedly the case that Jesus had been taken into the cave as if dead and had come out of it alive. But the formula, 'He is risen,' that was used by Simon was passed on to others, who could choose, if they wished, to believe in a resurrection if it helped their faith." End of quote. End of my talk.
Our church library has a copy of Dr. Thiering's work, and the book's called Jesus the Man. Her other books are Jesus of the Apocalypse and the book that Jesus wrote. Or you could look at her documentary film, The Riddle of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Much is footnotes and references, but with intriguing photos of the ruins of Qumran and the caves of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I'm going to read you two reviews. The first from the Times Saturday Review. "The sensational nature of the book's findings may disguise the strength of the research and scholarship which Thiering has deployed in the course of her narrative." The Australian magazine wrote, "Some will see her as the Antichrist, a mischievous scholar determined to destroy Christianity. To others, she will be a source of comfort and peace, enabling them to lead Christian lives without having to accept as fact Jesus' divinity, his miracles, the virgin birth and resurrection." And so the question remains, is Barbara Thiering a balanced judge of Jesus, or is she the evil scribe of Satan? You will have to read the book for yourselves.